My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. My fellow plebs, today's podcast is also brought to you by Moon Mortgage. As the world moves increasingly towards the mainstream adoption of Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage makes it possible to materialize your assets into real estate. Through the collateralization of mortgages with Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage will be launching lending solutions to allow investors to easily leverage their assets to purchase investments in owner-occupied property. Moon Mortgage's crypto mortgage will be launching soon for home buyers in Texas, Florida, and Colorado, and will also be open to investors in most states across the U.S. for investment properties. Welcome to the future of mortgages. Visit moonmortgage.com today to register and learn more. Moon Mortgage Residential is registered with the NMLS under number 235334. Today's episode is brought to you by Gordon Law Group. If you've tried to do Bitcoin taxes yourself, you know how complicated it is. You can spend hours and hours going through your transactions and researching tax forms, and you're still not sure if it's right or if the IRS will come after you. Or maybe you're so intimidated by Bitcoin taxes that you don't even know where to start. Gordon Law Group can help. Ditch the spreadsheets and feel confident with a bulletproof Bitcoin tax return. They can help with IRS payment plans, and they also provide a full range of legal and accounting services for Bitcoin and digital asset startups. Get your taxes done right the first time with the original Bitcoin and digital asset tax pros. Go to GordonLawLTD.com/BTC. As a bonus, they'll send you the ultimate Bitcoin tax guide for free. That's GordonLawLTD.com/BTC.
And we're live with another episode of FedWatch. My name is Ansel Lindner. This is your home for Bitcoin and macro with a little contrarian twist. We cover central bank news and try to understand where Bitcoin is going to fit into the global financial system going forward in the future. So I'm usually joined by my debonair co-host CK, but he is not here today. He is off in Oslo, but I am joined by my favorite co-host, Nolan Bowerly. Nolan Bowerly, how are you doing today?
And so I love life and I am enthusiastic about the future of humanity.
Oh, that's a good way to enter there. So yeah, we have a big show today. It's going to be FOMC day was yesterday. So I brought out a few clips for that. Talk about the market effects, what the market thought of the rate decision. CPI, PPI also came out this week in the United States. ECB hiked rates. We're going to cover that. And of course, Bitcoin and some of the fallout from the SEC get caught up on that news. So if you guys are thinking that's sounding good, like, comment, subscribe. Also, it's important to subscribe to this channel because they're putting out a ton of great content. Live Oslo conference is airing now. So tick the bell and you'll get notified as soon as they are live streaming all that stuff. Nolan, your show is going out now on Bitcoin Magazine, correct?
We finally got it all plugged in, so I've been running my show on my own YouTube every morning at 8 a.m., but this week we finally managed to figure out how to do it on multiple channels, and we're doing some really fun AI thumbnails these days. So today we had BRICS 2. We were talking about BRICS 2 and the potential for Bitcoin being on the agenda, just a rumor, not that big of a, you know, we're probably dealing with fake news spin somewhere, but nevertheless, you're starting to hear people chatter because the BRICS 2 Bitcoin meeting will kick off in August, and that there is even some potential chatter that Bitcoin is going to be on their agenda to address is worth talking about. So we were doing that today, and we had a a pretty cool Midjourney generated brick wall with the Bitcoin logo in it. So there you go.
And you're going to teach me how to do that stuff. I've spending a long time on my thumbnails for my stuff. But yeah, you guys can find me, bitcoinandmarkets.com. Bitcoin and Markets is my other podcast. Of course, we've been doing this now with Bitcoin Magazine for a couple of years. And we've been keeping you ahead of the curve on all of this stuff, macro, predicting what's going to happen geopolitically in the world. And we've been very, very accurate on the show. So make sure to like, comment, and subscribe. Okay, Nolan, are you ready to jump into today's topics? Should we start with Bitcoin or should we go to Powell first? What's your take?
Well, it's a busy week. And I'd say Powell sort of stuck out because, you know, it's one of these things, right? They take up a lot of energy. It's like we even see in politics, right? You know, there was one person who took up all the energy in the room the past couple of days. And I think for good and bad reasons. And I'd say the same story mimics itself here when we're dealing with the Fed Reserve. And so let's go with Mr. Powell first.
Okay, yeah. And the CPI and all that stuff, that ties into the FOMC as well, because like one of the big things about CPI now as it's coming down is what does that mean for future rate hikes? So CPI is always in context of the Fed. So yeah, the Fed was the big highlight this week. How should we set this up? Okay, so they did not hike rates. They maintained rates at 5 to 5.25%. They called this a hawkish pause because they ended up, have you heard of the dot plot? You know what the dot plot is? That is where all of the governors and voting members, they put a dot where they think at the end of each year where the interest rate is going to be. Well, those went higher, even though the target range stayed the same. So this was, they said this, they're calling this a hawkish pause. But anyway, I have a few slides with some images first of what he talked about. They also updated their summary of economic projections, which is important. So Chris, if we get slide number 4, please. And this is what they expect for real GDP. And I put a little dashed line at 0. So you can see that, yes, we did dip down below that in 2020. But so far here, real GDP has not gone negative. The U.S. is kind of in a unique position because Europe has slumped into recession now, official recession. I think China is in a recession, even though their numbers will never say that. So the U.S. is kind of unusual here or unique in that they are not projecting us to go into negative territory on real GDP. Stop me whenever you want to comment here, Nolan. I have 2 more slides.
Yeah, it is relative to that American sort of bucking the trend here, you know, and on my show, I'll tell you, you know, we dunk on Biden pretty much every day. We definitely dunked on the CHIPS Act. We definitely dunked on the Inflation Act, you know, as in kind of, you know, definitely saying this guy's not up for the job, but I got to give him credit just because if you get things wrong, it's good to mention it. I don't think we're totally wrong, but it looks like manufacturing is enjoying a renaissance in America. I saw people chattering about that this week, and that's great to hear. And what it does look like is the CHIPS Act did have some effect. It looks like it's a lot more specialized than I think, you know, in any competency to comment on, you know, high-end chips and what's going on with Taiwan and all that kind of stuff and design and can you even manufacture them. So I don't know the answers to any of that, but it does look like some good net positive is coming to American manufacturing. And so some of those things have worked out. So that's great news.
Yeah, I've seen the construction is the more resilient, one of the more resilient like industries right now. Everything's kind of falling, but construction is falling less than everything else. So that's important to know. I also wanted to point out about this real GDP before we move on is that what I have been saying for pretty much since the pandemic was that we were going to return to a post GFC normal of low growth and low inflation, not recessionary technically, but you know, around 1% growth going out in the future. And that's now what it looks like. Even the academic economists are starting to agree with that. And that's kind of bad company, I guess, to have the academic economists are agreeing with you. But I think this is starting to sink into the market that, you know, we're not necessarily going to go into a hard recession or anything. We're just going back to post GFC normal of low growth and low inflation.
And low energy. Low energy.
Yeah.
You know, low energy. These guys are hell bent on bringing the energy down, which I think is what you do so well on this show, Ansel, is sort of bring in that energy talk as well, as far as how the petrodollar functions and how all of these things line up, because it is important, right? This continues to be ideologically where they might be headed for a BRICS wall, right? And things, you know, that's what makes Bitcoin so interesting at this moment in time, is that it seems to be the way to focus the conversation on almost every single issue that's facing these people. So mm-hmm. when you're predicting, just like the academics, what you're actually just observing is the whole thing is on kind of life support, you know, like not just using low energy. It is low energy, right? It is the Jeb Bush of financial systems that we're living with right now.
Yeah. I mean, after a decade or two of kicking the can down the road, it's everyone starts getting like literally depressed. Mm. And that turns into a literal depression mm-hmm. as well. So, okay, let's go on to the next slide. This is their estimates for core PCE inflation. So this is a specific type of inflation, quote unquote inflation, but a price index that they use, personal consumption and expenditures. And this is the core portion that they think shows, you know, can give you an idea of inflation expectations going forward. You can see it's coming down relatively slowly. We see CPI now dropping below 4%, which we'll get into here in a second, but their projections are for this to slowly come down and trail off. And any thoughts, comments on this, Nolan, before we go to the next?
Yeah, week? I'm surprised you're seeing even some of those dot plotters as high as they are. You know, you can sort of see, other than the groceries and a few of these other things look like they are sort of stabilizing. So I understand why they're projecting maybe interest rates on the dot plot, but here on inflation, I'm just surprised there's even some that are that high. It seems like most people feel the trend is for this laggard number now.
Yep. Okay, on the next slide, that is the dot plot that we were just talking about. Producer Chris, can we get the next one, please? And this is showing, I put the red dot at the end of this year. You can see that the consensus is for 5.6%. We are at, remember, 5 to 5.25. So that is another, at least one hike by the end of the year. That is their consensus. And then each year forward from here, they think the rates will be lower. But this was part of this hawkish pause that I was mentioning. They didn't raise rates, but their dot plots went up. So it's kind of a contrast.
When you say 5.6, that sets off a bell in my mind. I've never heard it anything but divisible by 0.25 or 25 basis points. So did they ever hit a random number like 0.6? I mean, maybe. I don't know.
No, and that's interesting, because when I was listening to the press conference yesterday, most of the questions were about why the pause. Why the pause when you are signaling that you're going to hike more? Mm. Why the pause? I'm like, yeah, why not just raise it by, say, 1.25 instead of around 25 basis points? But of course, that's not an option. They always move by 25 basis point increments. I think it goes back to the old days when they used to measure interest rates by fractions. Mm. You know, they never used
decimals.
Decimals till I want to say the 90s or something like that is when they went to decimals. So this is still kind of a holdover from that, but that 5.6 is an average.
That's what I figured. Yeah.
Okay. So now I think we are ready to jump into Powell's comments. I have asked producer Chris to line up these three, and I don't really want to set them up other than to say, see if you can notice any sort of narrative mismanagement maybe by Powell in these clips.
Thanks, Howard Schneider with Reuters. I was just wondering if you could help us understand the narrative here, because it feels like there's been a level shift in the dots, stronger GDP, less of a hit to unemployment, slower progress on inflation. And I'm wondering, in this sort of, where's the disinflation coming from? Sure. The labor market's going to be stronger, it looks like. It's not coming from there. Demand's not coming down all that fast, according to GDP. You've doubled your estimate of GDP. So what's the narrative here? It seems like it's getting more immaculate rather than more messy.
So you're right that the data came in, I would say, consistent with, but on the high side of expectations. So, and if you go back to the former SEP, the last SEP in March, you will see that growth moved up. These are not huge moves, but growth estimates moved up a bit. Unemployment estimates moved down a bit. Inflation estimates move up a bit. And, you know, all three of those kind of point in the same direction, which is, you know, that perhaps more restraint will be necessary than we had thought at the last meeting. So although the level, frankly, is pretty, the level of 5.6 is pretty consistent, if you think about it, where the federal funds rate was trading before the bank incidents of early March. So we've kind of gone back to that. So your question is, where's the disinflation going to come from? And, you know, I don't think the story has really changed. The committee has consistently said and believed that the process of getting inflation down is going to be a gradual one. It's going to take some time. And I think you go back to the three-part framework for core PCE inflation, which is, we think, as good an indicator as you can have for where inflation is going forward. You start with goods. With goods, we need to see continued healing in supply side conditions. They've definitely improved a substantial amount, but if you talk to people in business, they will say it's not back to where it was. So that's one thing, and that should enable goods prices to continue, goods inflation to continue to come down over time. In terms of housing services inflation, that's another big piece, and you are seeing there that new rents, new leases are coming in at low levels, and it's really a matter of time as that goes through the pipeline. In fact, I think any forecast that people are making right now about inflation coming down this year will contain a big dose of this year and next year will contain a good amount of disinflation from that source, and that's, again, probably going to come slower than we would expect. That leaves, you know, the big sector, which is a little more than half, pardon me, of the core PCE inflation. That's non-housing services. And, you know, we see only the earliest signs of disinflation there. It's a sector. It's a very broad and diverse sector. I would say in a number of the parts of that sector, the largest cost would be wage costs. It's the service sector, so it's heavily labor intensive. And I think many analysts would say that the key to getting inflation down there is to have a continuing loosening in labor market conditions, which we have seen. We have actually seen, you know, I go through a number of indicators suggesting there's been some loosening in labor market conditions. We need to see that continue. I would almost say that the conditions that we need to see in place to get inflation down are coming into place, and that would be growth meaningfully below trend. It would be a labor market that's loosening. It would be goods pipelines getting healthier and healthier and that kind of thing. But the things are in place that we need to see, but the process of that actually working on inflation is going to take some time.
Okay, so I'm going to point out a few things. That was a little bit of a longer clip, but the rest of them are going to be shorter than that. The question pointed out that the data does not support a pause. Okay, it looks like inflation is going to be staying higher for longer. It looks like maybe the employment is looking even better than it was just last meeting. Some of these things are looking better. Why pause if their goal is to, you know, clamp down on the demand side and clamp down on the economy? Why pause? It doesn't make any sense. And he went through that whole spiel detailing out exactly why it didn't make sense. And I think that this is a major, major messaging blunder by the Fed. We'll see how it turns out in the markets, but there's no reason to pause. And the rest of the time, these questioners, they from the financial press there, they pick up on this and they keep hounding on the same question. We'll see the next one. So Nolan, any comments on that?
When he was talking about the softening of the labor market, what was he hoping for?
Layoffs.
Yeah, that's what I heard, right? So his plan to fight inflation is that, is that what I heard?
Yep.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee, a city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.
Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts, Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.
Yep, he wants a softening labor market so that demand will fall. Yeah.
Yeah. So exactly, and demand will fall, but that will give, and then the big payoff here is that companies can get their supply chains in order. Is that what I heard the grand plan is?
Well, no, that's gonna take demand down. Which if exactly. you have, if you give a little bit more time for supply chains to get in order,
that's what I mean.
With demand going down, then yeah, it's supposed to bring prices down, which is what they're trying to do, bring inflation down.
The master plan is to make it so people can afford to buy a bunch of junk, and then the people who are shipping and transporting the junk will have time to fix their inventories because they got screwed during the pandemic. Once they're finally not stressed out, I guess then we just hope people get jobs back and they can start ordering the junk again, or what?
I guess so. Or they cut rates like crazy.
Let's go, Jay. Come on. That's what I heard. I heard someone who, you know, it's like that thing. It's like what you do well, Ansel. You explain complicated things simply. For whatever he's up there dancing for, skating around for, you know, 15 minutes about, you know, why'd you do this or why didn't you do this? You see someone with the signs of a type of cognitive dissonance. He's just spouting out a bunch of words and none of it actually made sense to me. And I think I'm someone who can understand this kind of stuff. Right. I have experience with these central banks. That was my job, was for a long time setting up the meetings that he is doing. But I did those in Canada with our central banker, Mark Carney, who is one of the leaders of Clown World. He is one of the, isn't that funny? Isn't the simulation winking that a guy named Carney is helping run Clown World? I've always loved that. So, you know, that's how this stuff works. So that he's out there saying that is, I think, really disconnected from reality in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, only going to benefit Bitcoiners, because the more and more people hear these folks who are supposed to have a silver tongue and it's exposed as being just as corny and cringe worthy, because we all know you're lying, you know, like at least the old guys were slick about the lying, right? Like you forgot, you got a little bamboozled, but when they're down to really hoping to choke the labor market, and as I heard him say, soften the labor market, because look, what you know, at this point, the data is so degraded, GDP and all these things. The only thing that we can really actually cast any orientation on as far as how the economy is doing is labor market participation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only lighthouse I've been using for the past couple of years since COVID, in terms of how much do we worry about economic collapse, yes or no, has been labor. Labor has been the one thing that I've been saying, okay, that's good. If you get that right, you know, and you get your energy policies right, yeah, you're going to be fine, right? We don't got to worry about this and that, and, you know, we'll be fine. And when I hear him actually talking about destabilizing the only solid footing left in the American economy in order for his stupid thing to get regulated, I say, let's buy more Bitcoin. Smash the buy button.
Yep.
Smash a buy.
Well, it's interesting because their dual mandate is maximum employment and stable prices.
Well,
what he's doing is he's sacrificing one half of his mandate for the other half. He's trying to soften the labor market.
Now, if we were still in the zone we were in a few months ago, when it looked like eggs were going to go run away and protein was going to go run away, and, you know, then I would say, okay, like honestly, the one thing that would make me say soften the damn labor market is, you know, $25 cartons of eggs. Mm-hmm. But that's all done. We're good. We're going to live, right?
Right.
The egg chain did not collapse. We're going to survive. We're going to be good. It's summertime. We made it again.
Well, so before we move on to the next clip, I wanted to bring up this idea of labor hoarding and get your input on this, or your opinions. Is this idea of labor hoarding is that these companies, they really need to lay off workers because the economy is not going so well. but they resist laying off those people because it's so hard to hire new people back again on the next cycle. So they hoard these people and don't fire them. Well, that is kind of the kind of standoff here with Powell. He's going to tighten until these labor hoarders dump those people. So what are your thoughts on that?
I've never heard that, but that fits my worldview. I think I've seen that through the marketplace a few times. I would say it's probably not the type of people that are coming through a lot of labor numbers. Like, I feel like these are more contractually based things. But maybe that's just because that's my lens on the planet. So, you know, that's just been my impression there. I don't know if a lot of the, as we call them, W-2 filers in America are caught up in the labor hoarding. But yeah, it fits my worldview of what's systemically happening contractually out there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, let's roll on to the second clip.
Nick Timiraos of the Wall Street Journal. Chair Powell, what's the value in pausing and signaling future hikes versus just hiking now? I mean, not to be flippant, but I don't lose weight just by buying a gym membership. I have to actually go to the gym. 16 of your colleagues put down a higher year-end 23 rate today. A majority of you think you're going to have to go up by 50 basis points this year. So why not just rip off the Band-Aid and raise rates today?
So first, I would say that the question of speed is a separate question from the question from that of level. Okay, so, and I think if you look at the SEP, that is our estimate, our individual, it's really accumulation of our individual estimates of how far to go. I mentioned how we got to those numbers. In terms of speed, it's what I said at the beginning, which is speed was very important last year. As we get closer and closer to the destination, and according to the SEP, we're not so far away from the destination in most people's accounting, it's reasonable, it's common sense to go a little slower, just as it was reasonable to go from 75 basis points to 50 to 25 at every meeting. And so the committee thought overall that it was appropriate to moderate the pace, if only slightly. And there are benefits to that. So that gives us more information to make decisions. We may try to make better decisions. I think it allows the economy a little more time to adapt as we make our decisions going forward, and we'll get to see. You know, we don't know the full extent of the consequences of the banking turmoil that we've seen. We it would be early to see those, but we don't know what the extent is. We'll have some more time to see that unfold. I mean, it's just the idea that we're trying to get this right, and this is if you think of the two things as separate variables, then I think that the skip, I shouldn't call it a skip, the decision makes sense.
All right. So there he was asked by the Fed whisperer. Timiraos is his name. He's kind of the one people suspect has an insider that's feeding him information. But he asked about, you know, hey, if you say you're going to raise rates by the end of the year, why not do it now? Why wait? Why pause? So they got themselves backed into a corner here. They signaled more rate hikes, but then paused. And I think that it exposed this just mismanagement of the narrative. They see that these dot plots might be just propaganda. And so I think people are honing in on this, that this was, you know, the Fed is done. The Fed is going to cut next before they hike. And they're pulling apart Powell's speech here. So what are your thoughts, Nolan?
Well, I think it's the way I see this being a big invitation to structural change in America. Good for Bitcoin, good for Bitcoin. But the more he wavers, the more he tries to spin up a defense, the more the political folks who are already passing these $5 trillion debt ceiling increases. And all that stuff. So you get the debt ceiling last week. So he's got to start facing that the political opponents have far less respect for his job and his mandate and are going to overtly make the money political. And his job, of course, is to stick to the mandate, right? Stick to the price increase or price stabilization and labor market optimization and targeting of inflation rates. But you already are hearing people on the political side, we don't need to care about inflation, we don't need to care about these things. You're already hearing more and more people, especially on the extreme left, that's now calling for UBI and for no people to go without food stamps and stopping the rollback of food stamps and all that stuff. So you're seeing excuses for political logic to start taking the vacuum that he creates from his vacuous opinions and his very easy to alter versions of reality. Because that's the whole thing, right? His stuff sounds untrue because it is simply an easy to alter statement about what's happening around us. Like, anyone can argue with anything that he's saying because he's basically negotiating with himself, right? He's just sitting there like, and that's what I see so weird about this scenario. They were ready to taper off the lack of forecastable certainty or the amount of ambivalence in the American economy with this actual meeting. This was the one that was supposed to set an easy summer course. Mm-hmm. And everyone was supposed to just plug and play and allocate and start getting back to things as usual. This makes it feel like they've created this impending new era for which everyone needs to hoard labor or
more hikes. Yeah.
More hikes, more worries. So look, the more these fellas try to tell us they have a magic wand, the more the magic wand is shown to be the stick that it is, the more that this conductor stick doesn't actually get politicians to dance anymore, the more they will start asking for the politicization of the dollar to a greater extent, the more it becomes food stamps, and the more Bitcoin makes sense to everybody who needs to preserve their wealth. So that's what I'm seeing.
Awesome. Well, we have one more clip. We can get through this, and then we're going to go to the Bitcoin chart and see what Bitcoin did in reaction, if this was a reaction to the FOMC. We'll see how Bitcoin has done over the last week. But producer Chris, ready for the next clip?
Go to Chris.
Thanks. Chris Rugaber at Associated Press. You mentioned that many of the trends are in place that you want to see. Core services ex housing has come in pretty low in the past couple of months. And as you noted, a significant portion of core inflation is now housing prices. And then we've had some quirks in used car prices. So given that these trends are in place, I guess I'm sort of asking the flip side of Nick's question, why signal additional rate hikes? Aren't things headed in the direction you need? Why not simply give it even more time? Or I mean, it's surprising to see so much hawkishness in the dots, given what we're seeing recently.
Yeah, so, you know, we've we're 2.5 years into this, or 2.25 years into this, and forecasters, including Fed forecasters, have consistently thought that inflation was about to turn down, and typically forecasted that it would, and been wrong. So I think if you look at the core PCE inflation overall, look at it over the last 6 months, you're just not seeing a lot of progress. It's running, and it's running at a level, you know, over 4.5%, far above our target, and not really, you know, moving down. We want to see it moving down decisively. That's all. We're, you know, of course, we are going to get inflation down to 2% over time. We want to do that with the minimum damage we can to the economy, of course, but we have to get inflation down to 2%, and we will. And we just don't see that yet. So, hence, you see today's policy decision, both to write down further rate hikes by the end of this year, but also to, you know, to moderate somewhat the pace with which we're moving.
All right. So once again, it doesn't make any sense because he's saying, you know, inflation, quote unquote inflation, this is just price levels, are stubbornly high. So we have to pause. Like, it doesn't match. If inflation isn't reacting as they want it to, they should continue hiking rates. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't match with that. So I think that this, again, is a big misstep in the messaging from the Fed, and it's going to lose confidence in the Fed. And this could be a tipping point because, you know, one of their main monetary policy is confidence in the job that they're doing, that they can manage the market. And so then people are supposed to act that they have less uncertainty, or there's less risk because the Fed has their back on everything. But if you lose confidence in the Fed, it could actually be bad for markets. So, Nolan, what is your take on that? Is this a big mistake by the Fed?
Yeah, I think it is. I think, you know, I use the frame of the economy just being exactly that, a psychological engine. And it perpetuates based on sentiment. And it's the only way that people sort of come to work every day. And you know, you can feel it pervade an economy. You can feel when American cities feel enthusiastic. And right now, if you look across the continent, there's only one industry, two, let's say energy and Bitcoiners, that are enthusiastically going to work every day and enthusiastically building stuff. The rest of the folks are a little, you know, it's not so easy out there. So because they're broadcasting this kind of uncertainty, it has an effect. It has a butterfly effect. And I'm an accelerationist. So I say, let's keep going. Keep them in there. Powell, we love you. Keep it up.
All right. Well, let's get into the Bitcoin charts. Speaking of Bitcoin, this first one is going to be the daily, and it has been red since the FOMC. It looked like it broke support here of the 200 week, of the 128 day. You know, I've showed many different moving averages, and the big one here, I think, is this $25,000 dashed line. It looks like we're falling out of this pattern, headed right for that 200 day moving average, that orange one. Mm-hmm. So, Nolan, what are your thoughts on the price over the last, say, week? I mean, the SEC thing, of course, has been really affecting it, I think. But what's your overall take on the price?
Yeah, that feels like I don't feel like I expect a big upswing in the next little bit. You know, I feel like it's settling in for some good sat stacking summer optimized weeks and months. That's what I'm hoping for.
So this is the Bitcoin summer is just a stacking summer.
It's a Bitcoin stacking summer. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a look at the weekly chart. I think this one is a little bit more bullish, and CK seemed to like the weekly chart better than the daily, but you can see this also is falling off of support here and has a date with the 50 week moving average, the one in green. However, I'll note that the 50 week has turned positive, mm-hmm. positive slope. And traditionally in Bitcoin's history, that's a very bullish sign. That's pretty much marks the start of all of the bull action, is when that 50 decisively turns from a negative slope into a positive slope on the weekly chart. So Nolan, does this chart make you any more bullish, or do you think it's going lower from here and it's good stacking time?
No, I still feel like it is a bit of that sideways, but I do believe that we're starting the upswing in, like, I'm preparing as if we are moving in that direction in the next year, right? So that makes sense to me.
Halving's coming.
Exactly. I see a bit of a sideways summer, and I continue to predict on my show every morning that the 2024 US election is going to be focused on Bitcoin, that it will be front and center, and that in 1 year, that's all anyone's going to be talking about. So it just is aligning with all of the subjects and all of the policy priorities and all of the candidates, and it's only going to continue. And so, you know, this looks like it's setting up the story that we all want to hear, right? It's called Elon's razor. The world, the most entertaining outcome is the most likely. And that's what I think we're in store for. This might be the most interesting year in Bitcoin ever coming up, which True. Is saying a lot, you know?
True. I mean, if this last week is any, you know, preview of what's coming, I mean, it's been pretty exciting. Let's take a look at one of the correlations that people have been talking about a lot over the last couple of years, is the stock market. So you can see it's just blowing out on their bull rally, mm-hmm. leaving Bitcoin in the dust, actually going the opposite direction here of Bitcoin. A lot of people are talking about, oh, finally the correlation is broken. Bitcoin mm-hmm. has decoupled from the stock market, but I don't think so. I think that it's the SEC mm-hmm. action, the kind of sentiment in the space. And give it another couple weeks, and Bitcoin might surprise us with a pretty hefty bounce, or the stock market might sell off. But I've been predicting the stock market to act similar to this. So this isn't surprising. What is surprising is the Bitcoin price. So Nolan, do you put any credence into this correlation at all, or is it decoupled?
Let's predict out a little bit on this SEC stuff, because this is a particular subject of mine. So for viewers who are unaware, I come from a law background. I was a lawyer before I got into Bitcoin. Not a real lawyer. I didn't pass a bar or anything. I went to law school and worked in that banking committee that I was mentioning. I helped write laws, and I'm familiar with how laws are passed and how to read laws and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, mm-hmm. I just want to put that out there. One of the things that I did enjoy in law is administrative law. Believe it or not, it's a really weird subject, but one that I took to. And a case that I've been following for a long time. So this is in the context of all this SEC stuff, right?
Yep.
So a case that I've been following for a long time is called the SEC versus SEC case, okay?
Okay.
And this is now in the Supreme Court. It began last year in May 2022 with the Jarkissi case. And what it comes down to is, so it, even go back, when I was in law school and when you start law and all of that stuff, these securities lawyers are kind of the brain surgeons they're looked at, right? The most complicated. Really? And yeah, in a way, like the most, you know, it's a tough business. Yeah. And even when you get into the laws, you start to realize how they're written and it is hard to follow and it's really hard to research. There's so many laws, there's so many provisions, it's so complicated. You can understand why it would sort of attract, you know, a little more horsepower, let's say. And so what happened was in 2022, a court in the United States had a look at what this person was complaining about, the Jarkissi case, which is that the SEC has so many of these administrative law judges, right? ALJs. And what they are basically civil servants that have been given the power of a judge. They're not judges, but the whole SEC with its enforcement wing has created its own judiciary. So I always had a theory that this was unconstitutional because what you're doing is you're not separating the powers. And that was the reason why, that was my theory. The reason why we thought the securities lawyers were so sophisticated was because they were existing in this hyper-specialized echo chamber and that allowed things to become inside baseball for just their own, you know, lawyers. And that's why no one can even understand the proceedings of the SEC. You have to hire such an expensive lawyer to even understand the mystical occult language they spoke in. And so what this Jarkissi guy said is the whole thing's a scam. You're actually unconstitutional. You're not allowed for a bureaucracy to delegate adjudication and enforcement power to itself, right? So they won. They won back. Wow. Yeah, so the district court said, you're right. The SEC actually has no right to be involved in enforcement. And the logic goes like this. It's exactly what I said about human resources, that they deserve to have a trial by peers and a jury, and a normal civil law judge should be able to understand the provisions of all securities laws in the country. It shouldn't be that complicated. So the reason why it became corruptible, according, like, they don't even get into whether or not it's been corrupted, but it opens up the logic within the reasoning of the court to say, no, that's why you can't do this. Your constitutional rights are that your due process should be understandable to even, if it's not understandable to a judge, you got a problem.
Right.
If a lay judge who is a judge can't understand securities law because it's become so complicated, then you've got this, you know, sort of issue. And now, you know, I love sort of symmetrical historic arguments, but did you know who set it up to be this way? It was RFK's granddaddy. He created the SSE.
Oh, really?
He did. He was the creator, the first ever commissioner of the SSE. So what's amazing is his understanding of corruption of the medical industry actually dovetails with his own. He has not mentioned his understanding of the corruption of the SEC until now, but it will be very obvious and easy for him to graft his understanding of the corruption of the medical profession in America onto the SEC, because it's his own family's legacy. I mean, it's literally his granddad who created it. And so my prediction is the Supreme Court, and it makes all of these administrative judges in America to be unconstitutional, something like 4,000, 5,000 of them across all departments.
Wow.
So the Supreme Court is going to hear it. And I'm telling you, just based on my understanding of the Supreme Court, they're going for it. Because this is exactly where you're striking into the federal state balance of power. The SEC is already sketchy about whether or not the federal government had the competency to create it in the first place, right? It was done during the Depression when people were sort of looking the other way about constitutional sovereignty and all these things. But it ought to probably be a state's rights thing anyway. So I think you're about to get a fractured SEC. And if the amount of corruption that we're seeing sort of pouring out of it right now, because, you know, the Prometheum story, have you heard this one?
Yes.
It's getting fishy out there. And old Gary can't dance that well. So I love seeing him up there being the guy defending. He just looks so suspicious, right? He's so weird looking that he can't help but think he just looks like a villain. He looks like he looks like a villain, you know?
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see. He's always looking like he's up to something. So we'll see.
Well, so this, if they, this is successful in the Supreme Court and they get rid of all the kind of, I guess, pseudo judges that they have out there, is this like a strike against the deep state? You know, this is a strike against the executive branch overreach, right?
Yeah. I would, so when I would say deep state, I would put a bit of intention onto deep state the way I would use it. So I would not say these are intentional deep staters. I think these are people who just have never questioned bureaucracy, whether or not it should go this far. And I think it's just runaway stuff. And that's what the Supreme Court will stop. And yes, it will shrink the federal government. That's ultimately the point here, is that what has become a bureaucrat ought to have been part of the division of powers. It's not an argument really even about states' rights in a sense, right? I'm adding the states' rights argument onto it, but it is about a diminishment of federal executive branch control, because that's exactly what happened. The judges were executive. Now, it's enough that they appoint them. Like, that's enough, right? Usually to have some sort of corruption come in. Mm-hmm. What was happening was they weren't just appointing them. They were making the rules by which they were adjudicating, thereby estranging them from the reality of most people. And that's why it took to places where, you know, Gary Gensler can do even more sort of word salad stuff than we saw Jerome Powell just do in his testimony. But imagine Jerome
that's
Powell.
Hard.
Yeah, imagine Jerome Powell was adjudicating transactions, right?
Like, yeah.
So,
well, sorry to break you off there, is how would you, you know, bring that to connect with the current stuff the SEC is doing against Coinbase and against Binance? And what are your thoughts on the last week?
So that's exactly it. It's that because they're in charge of so much of the regulation and enforcement tied in together, these things haven't proceeded in the way they ought to have, because previously, people at Coinbase have been saying, like, how do we apply? You know what I mean? Like, I can remember Coinbase buying a broker dealer in 2017. So how is it that they're getting sued for securities fraud, you know, when they've had a broker dealer apparently? And it like, none of these things were, you know, I don't think Coinbase was out to screw anyone. Now, I get why people would say, oh, they listed a bunch of shit coins and this and that. That was a separate process, right? And, you know, what I'm talking about is just their desire to register as someone who can sell securities, right? Not the quality of the securities. That's sort of in-house once you're a broker dealer, right? That you can administer yourself. And then you have to live with the SEC rules. So that part I'm willing to accept. But in their case, when they're saying they want to sell securities, are buying companies because they have a securities license, and then they still get in trouble for dealing securities. Look, I worked in strategy at Kraken, so I knew what it was like. I mean, Kraken were a great example. We went out and got a banking license in order to be a cover for anything that we might have trouble with. And still, they got sued years later, even though everyone in the company was 100% oriented towards not stepping on any toes, doing things the right way, being compliant. And the avenues were just never presented. So what I see is, I don't need to see proof of corruption when things like this happen, right? Mm-hmm. I don't need to see the proof. If they can't explain why they couldn't have a path to being legit, and now they're suing people for not for being illegitimate, those exact folks who are trying to be legitimate, and he's sitting around with people like SBF and now these Promethium folks and all that, you know, to me, okay, he thinks well about Bitcoin. That's not enough for me to be okay with his overreach of a department that's in gross need of a comeuppance and you know, sort of a measuring stick to show how much influence they should have in American markets. Should it be like this? It looks like they're doing a terrible job. So
yeah,
probably not.
Well, I think you and I are on opposite ends of this debate, because I think that the path was Bitcoin only the whole time. The thing is, like, if you want to be a snake oil salesman, of course the SEC is not going to license you. All coins are scams. And they knew it from the beginning. Bitcoiners have been saying it the whole time. And they even,
That's a separate issue, Ansel. I agree with you mostly on that, but that's a separate issue.
Then what?
Than them enforcing rules that they never made clear. It's the not making clear that I have a problem with.
Well, the rules were clear from the beginning. The Howey test has been around for decades and decades. So it was exactly clear. And this is going back to writings in 2014 in the Bitcoin space, saying that all these things are unregistered securities and they're all going to go down. Yet Coinbase went forward, tried to gaslight the industry saying they're not securities when we all knew that they were. So where, the path to compliance was clear. Don't sell unregistered securities. But they did it anyway and tried to tell us they weren't unregistered securities. So I don't have any sympathy at all for Coinbase and Binance, especially if they're commingling funds.
Those are separate questions.
Yeah.
Not having sympathy for them is not the same as saying Gary Gensler is doing his job and the SEC is right in this issue.
Right.
The punishment can fit the crime, but the judge and jury shouldn't be the same person no matter what. And that's what we've got, right?
Yeah. I see your point there. And I think that could also make for this slow roll of this whole thing, because the bigger the bureaucracy, the slower things roll. And so maybe if they get rid of this big bureaucracy, mm-hmm. then things will go a lot faster. I don't know. But yeah, we're not going to, CK and I said last week, we're not going to solve any of this on the show. It's just interesting to see the two different sides and get into a little bit of a debate. So any more on this with the
I actually didn't even form any industry specific opinions mm-hmm. on the SEC because I'm so focused on this constitutional aspect, because it's something mm-hmm. that I've been saying for a long time. Yeah. As I said, it's something that I noticed years ago, about that what linked these securities lawyers as best in class, and why was that? And it answered a lot of questions for me. So for me personally, I just have one of these things that I predicted it years ago and it's happening. So I'm more reveling in that it's actually happening.
Yeah.
I'm worried about Coinbase and all these folks. You know?
Yeah. So do you have any thoughts though on how these actions are going to affect the price? Do you think that it's
to go back to the beginning. So I think, again, it's like that sentiment. Once we see that they can't adjudicate, the shitcoins are going to trade again at volume. New ones, there'll be a whole bunch of new ones. They've always got to replace them. The ones are out of gas, so there'll be some new things that come. And they'll be the same battle plan as we saw before. There'll be tons more unregistered security slinging. But this time, indeed, it will definitely benefit Bitcoin, as it always does. Because remember, it's something that Bitcoiners should appreciate, I think. Although my prediction on hyper-Bitcoinization is focused more on the energy market, benchmarking their wealth and performance and settlement and all that on Bitcoin, right? So once we do enter a world where we don't care so much about the US dollar exchange rate with Bitcoin, it will really be energy numbers that we're looking at, and Bitcoin sort of aligning the global energy market, replacing the petrodollar as the reference rate for energy. But all of that has already been experienced in the shitcoin world, in the sense that the shitcoin world already has measured its output success by Bitcoin dominance relative. True. So Bitcoin has already been the reserve asset class of an industry, whether you like that industry or not. Bitcoin has been the reserve and has behaved as the reserve asset of an entire scammy industry.
Yeah.
And look, we can say whatever you want about that. That's Bitcoin's destiny to do things like that, right? It's for crackheads too, right? It's for crackheads. Yes, even the crackheads can have guns. And even the crackheads can have Bitcoin, okay?
And they can have shitcoins too. Yeah.
And they can have all the shitcoins they want. And so, simply because of that fact, once the shitcoin engines get revved and once they start committing more generational financial crimes on boomers and they start sucking more of that inheritance and more of that wealth transfer into the coffers of the meme coiners and the shitcoiners, it goes where it belongs in the end, into Bitcoin, after a long convoluted strain. So anyway, it's going to be some nice price action, nice volatility, let's say, right?
Well, I've been saying that recently with all of this action against the altcoins. Altcoins will never go away, but it's the halving's coming, the hype cycle is coming, And if there's not as many substitutes for people coming into the space, that's going to focus all this incoming energy onto Bitcoin. What is your thoughts in on that?
Yeah, I think it is. I think we can actually get to that point where people start understanding that Bitcoin, even in the casual passersby, like, I think what you're talking about is what is it like for a person's first exposure to the industry? Mm-hmm. Right. And indeed, I think that what's going on does open up the door for people to not say, oh, I'm going to buy the top five coins. I think it does sort of end.
Yeah.
That as like, oh, I don't know what to do, so I'll buy Bitcoin and Ethereum and Ripple or whatever.
Well, yeah, and FOMO is concentrated into Bitcoin itself, yeah, instead of into all, yeah, these Doge coins and all, yeah, these other things. So I think that's going to be very bullish for the price. But we are getting close on time, dude. We have like 4 minutes and we haven't touched on the ECB yet. So should we jump over there real quick?
Yeah, one more point on that, right?
Yep.
We talk about commodity, we talk about securities market. This is how extreme I think 2024 election is going to get for Bitcoin.
Did I freeze or did Nolan freeze?
Did I freeze? I'm good.
All right. How are we doing? Check one, check two.
I think I'm good. Yeah, I'm good.
Okay, sorry. You froze on my
side.
Yeah,
so real quick. This is how crazy I think 2024 politics are going to get for Bitcoin. Just to talk about where the FOMO is headed. You know, you're talking about SEC, we talked about commodities, we talked about all that for a long time, and that's where the argument's been forever. Look at the step up we're going to take. We're not going to be talking about regulating Bitcoin as either of those things in the 2024 election. Not sure it gets done, but we're going to be talking about regulating Bitcoin as currency, which means you can't tax currency, right? There's mm-hmm. no such thing as a tax on the US dollar's appreciation. It's not impossible. That's the difference of what they actually did in El Salvador, right? They made Bitcoin currency, which means it's impossible to tax. It's money. You don't tax money. And I'm not saying that that's exactly what's going to happen in the United States, but you're going to start having the conversations that it's going to be brought up. We're not just talking about it countering CBDCs and all these things that we love about Bitcoin as well, and unconfiscatable and blah, 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 all the things, all the positive attributes we know about. It's going to distinguish itself even in regulation, in the sense that it's going to be cast as money,
right?
Money. And that is going to explode people's minds, because once you start actually putting Bitcoin out there as like an untaxable asset, people are not going to want to look away. It's going to even yeah. be, it's going to make it that is just like Bitcoin getting in a wedding dress. You know what I mean? Like, there it is. There it is. It's getting old. Bitcoin's getting old. It's time to think about that kind of stuff.
Coming of age, yes. All right, Chris, let's go to slide number 11. And this is the ECB. I just want to get to this. I mean, we could talk for days and days about Bitcoin and the halving and the altcoins not being there and all sorts of things. But being FedWatch, we concentrate on the central banks. And we covered Powell's press conference at length there a few minutes ago. ECB, however, even though Europe is in recession, official recession, the ECB is still hiking rates. And this came out just this morning or today in Europe. The European Central Bank is all but certain to raise borrowing costs on their highest level or to their highest level in 22 years on Thursday and leave the door open to more hikes, extending its fight against high inflation, even as the Eurozone economy flags. Inflation in the Eurozone is still unacceptably high for the ECB at 6.1%. And remember, in the US, headline CPI dropped to 4%. So this is a big difference between 6.1 and 4%. More than three times its 2% target, the underlying price growth, which typically excludes food and energy, is only starting to slow. That is likely to keep the ECB on the tightening path, particularly after it failed to predict the current bout with high inflation. So they are going to continue raising rates in a recession. And this is completely counter to, now let's look at the US. The U.S. isn't in recession, doesn't look like it's going to be in recession anytime in the next, say, 6 to 12 months, and we're pausing with possible rate cuts coming soon. So a lot of money is going to be flowing into alternative assets from Europe and also into U.S. dollar-denominated assets. So, Nolan, any comments on, is the ECB dumber than the Fed?
Well, they're a little more boxed in, right? Their lie is a little further along than the Fed. They've been dealing with suspicion of competency for an extra couple of years, and they're probably, yeah. I mean, look, you know, they're already per person less wealthy and less productive than in America. Add to that their higher cost of energy and the cost of their energy policy mismanagement because they're energy illiterate. And they were, of course, so worried about Greta's feelings and tried to calibrate energy policy based on the happiness of a teenage girl. And that was a bad idea. And now they're paying.
Go figure.
Yeah, now they're paying for it, right? So now, like, they say it doesn't even count energy. It does in the sense that that's what we call a softened labor market, right? They're nothing. They already had it softened. It's already softened, right? They got what Powell's wishing for here. So that to me means they're a little ahead about driving this thing into the wall. They're going to have to compete with that euro on the energy market again next winter because, as I understand, they did sew up a lot of contracts till 2025 for energy, but nevertheless, there's unknowns.
Prices are starting to tick back up again. I was just looking at the European natural gas prices, and yeah, they're starting to tick back up. Mm-hmm. They came down way more than anyone could have expected and way faster, but now they are starting to tick back up. I just think it's crazy that Europe is in a recession. Germany, the powerhouse economy, is in recession for the first time in a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's like a slow moving economy, mm-hmm, because they are heavy industry dependent on,
industry down now, depending on the wind and the sun. Imagine you have a job in a factory in Germany. It went from being probably the strictest factory to work in when they were coming in the 1950s, they probably had a bit of cultural hangover from being strict and probably worked well in a factory. To now, when it's like, oh, it's sunny, I'm not working. Or it's raining. Yeah. It's raining. I'm not coming to work.
there's no wind today. I can't come
to work. Wind. All right. Yeah, well, and they're jumping all in on this no car business, no cars by 2030 or something crazy, you know.
Well, yeah, and they're anchoring their boat to China's economy, and that's not looking so hot either. But Nolan, I want to thank you for coming on today. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, join the show at 8 a.m. every day, and we do the breakup. It's a lot of fun. We talk about a lot of the stuff that Ansel talks about here, and we'll be talking a little bit about Bitcoin Amsterdam, October 12th to 13th. So that's what I got.
All right. Thanks, guys. And join me at bitcoinandmarkets.com. On the Telegram is t.me/bitcoinandmarkets. Do live streams Monday, Wednesday, Friday there. Appreciate it, guys. See you on the next one. What is up, audio listeners? Thank you for enjoying another episode of FedWatch. Down in the show notes, you will find all the appropriate links to our social media, the original version of this podcast, and community links. Also, check out bitcoinandmarkets.com, where I put out a free weekly newsletter every Friday. And there you can also help support the show by signing up to become a paid member. See you next time.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee, a city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.
Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at bitcoinmagazinepro.com.